The following programming is sponsored by the Pennsylvania Pro-Life Federation. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Positively Pro-Life, a podcast brought to you by the Pennsylvania Pro-Life Federation. Positively Pro-Life brings you inspirational stories, important legislative updates, and informative interviews as we restore and strengthen a culture of life. I'm Bonnie Finnerty, the Education Director at the Federation, and I am joined today by my colleague, Maria Gallagher, the Legislative Director at the Federation. Hello, Maria.
Hello, Bonnie. It's so good to be with you today.
Good to be with you. Well, today we have a very special guest, one that I remember from almost 20 years ago, actually 17 years ago. If Maria, other guests or viewers may remember what was dominating the news at that time. There was a young woman named Terry Schiavo in Florida. She had sustained a brain injury many years earlier, and she was battling for her life, but not because of the brain injury. Rather, a court order had deprived Terry of basic nutrition for over a two-week period, and that led to her death 17 years ago tomorrow. Her brother, Bobby Schindler, who was there through all of that, is with us today. He is the president of the Terry Schiavo Life and Hope Network. And he is here to tell us Terry's story and explain how his organization is supporting other families with medically vulnerable loved ones. In addition, Maria is going to be providing an update on a very important legislative matter, the Pennsylvania Constitutional Amendment, also known as the Life Amendment. First, however, we'd like to start with some inspiration. And this week, I would like to share an uplifting story from the pro-life website, Live Action. I will link to the full article in our show notes. I love this story. It really resonated with me because it shows that even out of the most difficult circumstances, good can emerge if we lead with love. It's a story of a 17-year-old young woman who in 1987 gave birth to a little boy. Her name was Janice, and she just knew she was not prepared to parent. So she and the baby's father, Earl, decided to place the baby for adoption. Now, while she knew it was the right decision, she also grieved that decision. And in the hospital, she told that baby how much she loved him, that she was sorry she couldn't raise him, and that one day she hoped they would be able to meet. A few years after placing that baby for adoption, Janice and Earl actually married and went on to have three more children, but they did not tell anybody about their firstborn son. In those days, adoption was largely a closed process with little communication between the birth parents and the adoptive parents, and there was still a strong stigma of shame attached to a teen pregnancy. But despite all that, Janice, in her heart, was yearning to make contact with the boy that she had given up years earlier. And then tragedy struck. Her husband, Earl, was killed in an accident. And in dealing with that trauma, Janice's counselor encouraged her to also deal with the adoption from the years earlier. And she was spurred to go ahead and try to find her son. She did get some contact information and she sent him a text, hoping and praying that he would respond, and he did. He said, "I had been waiting for this message my whole life." After 32 years, mother and son were reunited, and they discovered that they actually lived just 15 minutes away from one another. Janice's three sons were able to meet her firstborn son, and one brother commented, "He looked like my dad. He spoke like my dad. He acted like my dad. I was like, this is my dad 2.0. This is a last parting gift from my dad to me." And more meetings are on the horizon. Janice plans to meet with the woman who raised her precious baby, her son's adoptive mother. According to Janice, the secret she kept for so long turned out to be one of the biggest loves of her life. And she says that he was the best thing I ever did. He's a blessing, and the part of my heart that was missing is returned. I so commend Janice and Earl for making the brave decision to place their baby for adoption, a noble but not easy road. yet one that Janice is glad to have taken. Today, many couples are waiting to adopt. In fact, for every baby placed for adoption, there are 36 couples waiting for a baby to adopt. And the process of open adoption has been a blessing to many, many families. We do need to talk much more about life-affirming option of adoption and encourage young women facing an unexpected pregnancy to encounter stories like Janice's so that they know happy endings are possible. Maria.
Bonnie, thank you so much for that inspirational story. I wanted to give an update on a very critical matter that's now before us, the Pennsylvania Constitutional Amendment, also known as the Life Amendment. And this amendment is necessary because the abortion industry filed a lawsuit, which is now before the state Supreme Court, which calls for a so-called right to abortion and taxpayer funding of abortion under the PA Constitution. The only way to counteract this, if the Supreme Court were to rule in favor of the abortion industry, would be this constitutional amendment. The constitutional amendment is very simple. It simply states that there is no right to abortion or taxpayer funding of abortion under the Pennsylvania Constitution. It's known in the Senate as Senate Bill 956, and it's passed through the Senate Health and Human Services Committee. And it could come up for a vote at any time in the full Senate. So what we need to do is we need to contact our state senators and our state representatives and let them know that we want to pass this constitutional amendment. The amendment must pass through the Pennsylvania House and Senate in two consecutive sessions before it can be placed on the ballot for voters to decide. And we know from national public opinion polls that the vast majority of Americans oppose using their hard-earned tax dollars to pay for abortion. It's that simple. So please go to our website at paprolife.org and send a message to your state lawmakers urging them to pass the constitutional amendment. We know that the other side, led by Planned Parenthood, the nation's largest abortion operation, is flooding the phone lines right at this moment, trying to get this amendment taken off the ballot and trying to stop it from ever passing the state legislature. So we need to be out in force, letting our state representatives and state senators know that we stand for this constitutional amendment because we don't want tax funding of abortion, which only leads to more abortion. Bonnie.
Thank you so much, Maria. At this time, it is my honor to introduce our guest. Bobby Schindler is president of the Terry Schiavo Life and Hope Network and advocates for the medically vulnerable in honor of his sister, Terry Schiavo, who suddenly collapsed and was left with a profound brain injury. A full-time pro-life advocate, Bobby and his family have been instrumental in providing resources and support to more than 2,500 patients and families at risk of euthanasia, from physicians, hospitals, insurance companies, and others more interested in healthcare rationing than in providing basic life-affirming care for the most vulnerable. His writings have been widely published, including in the Wall Street Journal, Time, National Review, and he has appeared on many television shows, including Good Morning America, The Today Show, and EWTN. Bobby co-authored the book, A Life That Matters, The Legacy of Terry Schiavo, as a resource for those seeking to understand the true story of Terry's fight. Bobby lives in Cincinnati with his wife and a happy family of nine. He holds degrees from LaSalle University and Florida State University, as well as the National Catholic Bioethics Center Certificate in Healthcare Ethics. Bobby Schindler, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. It's wonderful to be here with you today. Thank you.
Bobby, can you tell us what your sister, Terry Schiavo, was really like?
Sure. Most people learned of Terry after her accident, so there wasn't a whole lot of reporting on before Terry. She was just a wonderful sister. We were 13 months apart. We grew up outside of Philadelphia. She had a great sense of humor. I guess the one way to describe my sister was her passion for animals. I remember her always talking about wanting to be a veterinarian, wanting to work in a zoo. She wasn't very active into sports. My younger sister and myself, we were more sports oriented growing up. But so she kind of did more of an animal thing, learning about animals. And we had a family dog, and she also liked to draw. She was a very good artist. And guess what she used to draw all the time? Animals. And she took a particular liking to drawing Disney animals. So, but she didn't have a whole lot of friends. She had a very small, close-knit friends, and she was very close to her family and her grandparents. And I just remember one thing about my sister was her sense of humor and just a lot of fun to be around.
Bobby, let's talk about the night of February 25th, 1990, when Terry collapsed at home. What happened that night and in the weeks and months after that?
Sure, and I wish we could spend more time to talk about Terry's case, but I'll try to just kind of give you a quick summary. Our entire family, my dad moved to St. Petersburg, Florida. Terry had, in 1986, Terry was married to Michael Schiavo in 84, but they had also moved after my parents had moved down. And once they learned my parents were moving to Florida, they were, I guess, somewhat newlyweds, so they moved to Florida. I also moved down in 1987. My younger sister Suzanne was there, but it was in 1990, as you said, when Terry was 26 years old and she had some type of accident at home while with her husband. And I happened to live in the same apartment complex, so my dad had called me after Michael called my dad and said something happened to Terry. So I was able to get there pretty quickly, and Terry was on the ground and struggling to breathe, and I didn't think I wasn't too concerned. Because I had saw her earlier and she seemed to be fine, but the paramedics got there shortly after I got there and knew right away there was something seriously wrong with her. But essentially, Terry went several minutes of without oxygen to her brain from her collapse, and she experienced a pretty severe brain injury that night. And really from that point on, she was depending on others for her care. She was disabled. However, from the way she seemed to be portrayed by Michael and her attorney later on, when Terry's case made publicity, you would think that Terry needed machines to keep her alive, and that simply was untrue. She was not brain dead. She was not in a coma. She was awake, communicated. She was able to communicate, responsive. And the only thing that was sustaining her was food and hydration. She had difficulty swallowing because of her brain injury and therefore needed a feeding tube to receive her food and water. And that was the only thing sustaining her, just like it sustains us. And back when this all happened initially, my family used to put Terry in his wheelchair and take her to get her hair done. We took her to the movies, places that were, you know, as I said, all she really needed was a wheelchair and we could have transported her anywhere. So. The way she was portrayed, I think, as I said, when the case was in the news because of the legal case, it was in many ways wrongly portrayed. But I think the most important thing is Terry had a severe brain injury and needed food and water through a feeding tube in order to deliver her food and hydration, and that's what was sustaining her.
You know, as you recount this story, I'm thinking that Terry might have been the first case of really legendary fake news in this country, because she was consistently portrayed as being brain dead. And that wasn't the case at all, was it?
No, she still is. I mean, if you go back, I mean, Terry's name still makes the news on occasion. I being involved in this issue, I see her name pop up in the media, and they're still regurgitating a lot of the inaccuracies that were reported back when this case back in 2005, even before. And you're right. It's she's constantly being misportrayed, her condition, the case, the facts of the case. The case, quite honestly, was built on lies. They had a lie to achieve what they were trying to achieve, which was to remove my sister's food and hydration. And our family was doing everything we could to stop it, but they were successful. In fact, we're speaking right now at a time when Terry was actually going through her 2-week starvation and dehydration death. at the request of Michael Chavo, her husband, which all started back really in 2000. But you're right, it's frustrating, but we're constantly trying to do our best to do everything we could to clear up a lot of the inaccuracies and a lot of the misinformation that exists about my sister's case.
And Bobby, I just wanted to add that I saw on your website, you have quite a few videos showing that Terry was responding to voices and directions that would run counter to the popular narrative.
Yeah, it's really inarguable. I mean, it's if you look at the videos, and it was, again, not to get in the minutia of the case, but one of the things that they had approved to the court is that my sister was unable to communicate, was non-responsive, and it simply wasn't true. Unfortunately, just a couple years after her accident, by the way, she was receiving aggressive rehabilitation within the first year of her collapse, and she was starting to respond. She was starting to form words, and we were very hopeful that she was going to continue, but it stopped shortly thereafter. Michael Chavo, again, her husband and guardian, basically from 1992 forward, warehoused and abandoned Terry. And when you do that to someone with that type of brain injury, they're going to deteriorate. But even with the lack of therapy and rehabilitation, the videos that you see were produced in 2002, and she still was yet able to respond at some level to commands and able to communicate as best she could. But she just wasn't able to do it consistent enough to get any type of pattern or any way of getting her to communicate where we could get her to answer questions, unfortunately. But she was able to communicate, and she was responding to therapy and rehabilitation. It was just a tragedy that she had been warehoused for as long as she was without receiving anything, not even a range of motion. I mean, she really, it was just really, as I said, tragic that she was treated in such a terrible way by what became her estranged husband, who was on a pursuit to end her life.
Now, let's make this very, very clear. How was it that Terry died? And tell us about that tragedy.
Right, so we're all, as I said, we're all living in Florida, and Michael had a change of heart, so he decided to petition the court and ask for permission to remove Terry's feeding tube. And he did this 10 years after Terry's collapse. So it went to trial in Pinellas County, Florida in January of 2000. There was a week-long trial. Michael was seeking permission to remove Terry's feeding tube, and the judge ruled in his favor. So our family went on our response was to do everything we could to stop it from happening legally. And it took about 5 years, and there was a lot that happened in between those 5 years. But during that time, the Florida legislature got involved, Governor Bush got involved, it made its way to Congress, the President of the United States got involved, the Vatican was involved, Pope John Paul was involved. So it was really started out as a local case and turned into a huge international battle between Michael and my parents and trying to keep Terry alive, but we were unsuccessful. So March 18th, 2005, Terry's feeding tube, after all the legal challenges were exhausted, her feeding tube was finally removed, and that's when it took 2 weeks before she died of a very severe dehydration, and it was one of the most inhumane, barbaric experiences witnessed that my family was forced to watch Terry die in such an inhumane way.
Michael, I remember following this in the news as a young mom with my kids at home, thinking that when this got into the court, the legal system would protect Terry's right to life. I just kind of had faith that that would happen, that somebody would see what was going on, but that didn't happen. Even though you had many depositions from medical experts saying that Terry wasn't brain dead, she was not in a persistent vegetative state, you had medical documentation. Can you talk about the legal system and what happened? Why did the judge decide the way he did, from what you understand?
We didn't either, quite honestly. We didn't think Michael would be successful with his petition, particularly with all the conflicts of interest at that time when Michael petitioned the court. But essentially, he went to the court and said it was Terry's wish. The decision the judge was made was based on Michael's hearsay evidence. There was nothing in writing. So it allegedly happened before Terry collapsed. And it took about 8 years before Michael came forward making this claim. So he, for 8 years, he never mentioned it to anybody. He went to the judge saying Terry wanted to die, supposedly. Our family said that he was essentially lying, that he never mentioned this before. And as I said earlier, this case was built on a lot of information that just wasn't truthful. And also Michael brought doctors to the court and said that Terry was never going to recover. Although there were doctors that believed she could have improved her condition if given the opportunity, because as I mentioned earlier, all therapy and rehabilitation was stopped back in 1992 or thereabouts. But the judge agreed with Michael. He ruled in his favor, and our family was shocked. And as I said, our response was to try and stop it from happening. But you're absolutely right. I mean, our family was blindsided. Didn't think we would ever be confronted with having to try and stop a human being from being dehydrated and starved to death. Just the very notion that what Michael was asking was just was something our family just couldn't even come to think the judge would rule in his favor. But nonetheless, the judge did, and then we did everything we could to try and stop it from happening. And we learned afterwards, once we got involved in this issue, that there are, I mean, the protections for people like Terry and the elderly and the medically vulnerable, we're seeing them being taken away more and more. And people like Terry and others, other types of population, are more at risk now than they were even when Terry was going through this this terrible tragedy.
How have you been able to advocate for those people who are in a situation similar to Terry's?
Sure. Well, in response to Terry's death, our family, and really a lot of it was motivated by a lot of the families that approached us during Terry's case, sharing stories similar to what they were caring for a disabled loved one, and they were worried that perhaps if they would pass away, what would happen to their daughter, their son, their loved one. So they asked us if we would, because of the case, the publicity of Terry's case, to continue fighting and advocating for people with brain injuries, the disabled, just really people medically vulnerable that are at risk of having their care either withdrawn or denied. And that's what our family did. We started the nonprofit advocating for others. And we built, just through our experience with Terry for 5 years, a lot of connections to the pro-life community, to organizations, to professionals, to attorneys, to doctors that were all stepping forward to help. Well, we kept these people in a kind of a database, so to speak, as resources. And we use them now when families would call us for help once we started this nonprofit. It's basically serving as patient advocates when they're in a situation where they needed help, whatever help it was that they needed, whether it was legal help or they needed help from a physician, helping with getting really exposing what was happening, we would use our resources as best we could to get the families the help they needed to try and stop the threat. And we've been pretty successful over the years getting the help families need, connecting them with the help they need, to really help their loved ones get the treatment and care that the families are asking for, and many times are being told no, quite honestly. And that's why the families call us, because they are being denied treatment for their loved ones, and they need help trying to get that treatment for their loved ones, and they don't know how to do it, so they call us to see if we can help them.
I think it's so admirable that you and your family have taken your own personal tragedy and have used that to help people today and walk their walk with them and help them with resources. What can people do to support your mission, your foundation, and what can they do to protect themselves and their loved ones?
Sure. Well, our website's lifeandhope.com. You can visit our website to kind of see the work that we do and how you can help. And I think the best way to protect yourself is to find a healthcare agent, someone, and this is different from a medical directive. A healthcare agent is someone that you would legally appoint to be your healthcare advocate, so to speak, if you're ever unable to speak for yourself. So they would step forward and be your voice, and they would fight for you to get the treatment. If you are in a situation where you're possibly being denied or withdrawn treatment They would be there to fight for you to get the treatment that you want. So you wouldn't have to experience something similar, perhaps, as our family experienced with Terry. So I think that's the best way today in our healthcare system, because there really is our healthcare. We deal with wonderful doctors, and there are facilities out there that I think do their best to work in the best interest of the patient. But we're seeing really this trend where, there's no other way to explain it, where there's just this attack on human dignity. And it seems to me that more and more administrators, the insurance industry, are more concerned. They're working for the best interest of the hospital rather than the patient. And they're more worried about cost and cost containment. So really the best way to protect yourself in today's healthcare system is if you ever are unable to speak for yourself, to make sure you have an agent that will fight for you and do what they can to get the treatment you want. And also sit down and speak with your loved ones about what's happening in our healthcare system today. Educate yourself, because you might not think this is something you might be confronted to having to do, but just like our family, one day things are fine, and the next, you might be faced with a crisis where you're now needing care, and so you really need to understand and educate yourself on how the healthcare system works.
Bobby, we probably have less than a minute left. What is your message to public officials as we mark the anniversary of your sister Terry's death?
Well, we have to do more to put laws into place. I mean, I know we can't depend on politicians this is really, I guess, understanding the dignity of the human being. But nevertheless, laws are one way that we can do better to protect the medically vulnerable. And I mean, one for example, medical feeding tubes have been reclassified as medical treatment. They used to be basic and ordinary care. But because they've now been reclassified as medical treatment, it's legal in all 50 states to either deny or withdraw feeding tubes from individuals. So just that one law there, with that one reclassification, has changed hospital policies, has changed statutes to put just countless medically vulnerable in a position to have their feeding tubes to either be removed or removed or withdrawn or denied, just like Terry. So. We need to find ways to protect medically vulnerable. If it has to be legislative, then that's the way that's what we have to pursue. But getting involved and recognizing there is a problem in our healthcare system today, and we need to do more to protect the medically vulnerable, to protect them, because as I mentioned earlier, much of these protections have been removed, and it's making it easier and easier to end their lives.
Absolutely. We thank you so much, Bobby Schindler. And remember, there's always a reason to choose life.